In the mid-50s, two men knocked over a kerosene stove during a fight at a concert. After fleeing the blaze, the guitar player realized he left his beloved Gibson inside. B.B. King then ran in and saved it. He later learned that the fight was over a woman named Lucille, and ever since, his guitars have borne that name. You can find Lucille at the Hard Rock in Hollywood, Florida. Thousands of other priceless pieces of rock history can be found at Hard Rock cafes, casinos, and hotels around the world. To learn more, visit hardrock.com.
Stephen's Underground Garage's coolest conversations, presented by Hard Rock Cafe, hosted by the Mighty Manfred.
It's time for your coolest conversations podcast in Little Stephen's Underground Garage, presented by Hard Rock. I'm the Mighty Manfred. Thanks for listening, and please remember to follow, subscribe, rate, and review. I'll be chatting shortly with Howlin' Play Almqvist, frontman and lead singer for the Swedish band The Hives. Their latest album is The Death of Randy Fitzsimmons and features our recent coolest song of the world, Smoke and Mirrors. We'll hear a portion of that now, followed by my interview with Belle on your Coolest Conversations podcast presented by Hard Rock in Little Stephen's Underground Garage. Mighty Manfred, and my guest today for our coolest conversations is Pelle Almqvist, the lead vocalist and frontman for The Hives. Their latest album, The Death of Randy Fitzsimmons, features this week's coolest song in the world, Smoke and Mirrors. How are you, Pelle?
Hey, I'm great. We know that. How you doing?
So, you guys, right, The Hives, you're from some small town in Sweden, I'm going to guess. Fagersta, how do you say that?
Yeah, Fagersta is how we say it, but that's good too. Yeah.
Not a very big town.
This is true.
Big town. I said not a very big town, maybe like 12,000
it's tiny.
People, so, yeah.
Yeah, 12,000-ish, something like that.
Yeah, I've read that your dad was a doctor, your mom a teacher. Sounds like a suburban, middle-class upbringing there. Did either of your parents play music?
My dad played like Dixieland jazz banjo. My mom did not.
And did your dad ever whip out the banjo as you were growing up in the household?
Yeah, I used to be excited. We played like Oh Susanna and stuff like that. I'd run around in a cowboy outfit in circles and shout along. So yeah, he used to entertain us with music.
Very
cool. And then at like six or so, I started my first band with my brother, who I'm still in a band with. And it was kind of like, we thought AC/DC, but it was more like, I guess what you'd call grindcore today. It was really atonal and nuts.
And you were how old?
I was like six at the time.
Six. So we're talking about your brother Nicholas Arson. He's a little bit older than yourself. How much older is he?
It's 1 year. Irish twins is what they call it.
Irish twins. Do you have any other siblings?
No, that's it.
Well, man, you know, rock and roll history.
I think they decided to stop there because they thought that's like, we're not going to do better than that. So they stopped there.
Well, rock and
they
roll
tried
history.
Once and they got my brother and then they got me and then they were happy, you know.
Yeah. Well, listen, man, rock and roll history filled with contentious relationships between brothers and bands. What is your relationship like with Nicholas?
Well, it's the same, I think. We used to fight physically every day until we, when we were like 14 and 15, we form the band, and then we mostly fight about songs, and less physically, more verbally. But yeah, there's definitely, I mean, a brother relationship is like, you know, people are like, don't you love your brother? Of course I do, but it's more complicated than that. Do you have brothers?
Yes, I do. Anyway, and
do you have older brothers?
Well, there's a long story. After my mother passed away, my father revealed that my younger brother and I have a full brother that was given up for adoption. And
all right, okay.
Yeah, yeah. So the reason I'll go on about the story just for a moment is that what was the best part of this was pretty funny. My younger brother, when we were sitting together and this news came out, my younger brother was with me, and he said, you know, I'll always be the baby of the family. I'll always be the youngest. But you, here he started poking me, you know, you are no longer the older brother. You're the middle brother.
That's where all the problems came from.
Yeah, absolutely. So your brother, you guys are forming bands. So your brother's playing guitar in the Hives. When did he start playing guitar?
Man, I think like a couple of years before that, maybe at like 12 or something. He was into like shredding. He is playing guitar in like the style of Yngwie Malmsteen, which is a really hard, it's a difficult style to start at. It shows his big ego. No, but he learned to do that pretty well, but I don't think he could play with other musicians. He could like all that kind of things. He can still do that stuff, but then when then he joined the band. I was in the band kind of slightly before him. And then he learned to play with other people admirably.
Well, do you play any instruments?
Yeah, I mean, I play all the stuff that you would find in a rehearsal space for like a Swedish rock band. So I play pretty good bass, drums and guitar, but not like, I don't do it live. I sometimes do a bit on a record or something, but mostly it's the other, we got pros for that, but I can play all those instruments well enough to like arrange songs and all that kind of stuff.
Well, the first album you guys did as a high is Barely Legal, that comes out in like 1997. And what, you're around like 19 years old at that time?
Something like that, yeah. Good research.
All right, well.
It was after you finished like the mandatory school in Sweden. You graduated like 19. I don't know what's comparable to. It's called gymnasium. And then you graduate that, and that's all the mandatory school you have. And then that's when we recorded our first album, the summer, like 2 weeks after graduation. And then that was wildly unpopular, mainly because I think the first pressing was like was 500 copies, and that sold up really quickly. And then they didn't really press anymore until we released our second album, which was kind of our. And then we were wildly popular all of a sudden.
Well, let me figure this out here. So you mentioned you being in the band before your brother. How exactly did you guys form the Hives?
Kind of a complicated, kind of like the story about your brothers. Yeah. There's a sixth guy, Randy Fitzsimmons, who now, as named from the title of our new album. So when we formed the band, it was actually six guys. It was me and the five other guys, and my brother joined like slightly later. And he, because we fought so much, my parents overheard him asking me if he could join the band. Like, I think I should play with you guys. And he's good, you know. So, and I said yes, and my parents were like, why did he say yes? I guess so. And since then, we've had a kind of a. Well, we have a good relationship. Personally, we have got a great relationship. We've only mostly like fight about the music, which is, that's meaningful to fight over as opposed to just fighting out your personal relationship. And but we do make good work together. So,
yeah.
So, a little bit of fighting, that's worth it. We're only interested in results here. If it takes some fighting, that's all right.
Well, let's share some love to these other guys in the band. There's Jelani Kallstrom, rhythm guitar player, drummer Chris Dangerous. And they date back from when you guys first formed the group. Is that right?
Yeah, the only one. Those guys. There was also a Dr. Matt Destruction. They were all there from the beginning.
Oh right.
And then 10 years later, Dr. Matt Destruction didn't want to tour anymore, really, or like he couldn't tour anymore. So we got Johan, the Johan and only, in as a replacement first. But then, like, you know, a couple of years of him being, you know, the replacement, he finally kind of became a real member of the band. And apart from the Johan and only, who's been there for 10 years, everyone else has been there for over 30 years.
Yeah. So Johan and only, he's the new guy still, right? You ever tease him about being the new guy 10 years?
Yeah, it's kind of like that. Yeah, of course. I mean, that's the way it goes. And like, I'm sure, you know, Ron Wood is still the new guy in the Rolling Stones, you know. Well, so, now like, he's actually got.
Tell me now, I want to know, like,
guys.
Vigilani and Chris, those two guys, were they classmates of yours?
We all went to the same school and stuff. And these were basically such a small town. Like, these were the only people interested in playing rock and roll in our town. And just turns out they were really talented. Or I don't really know what talent comes into it. It's just like, you know, that those 10,000 hours they talk about to be an expert at something. I think we'd done those like within the first year of forming the band. Like all we did was play music because we came from a boring small town. Those has to do. So we play music, eat a sandwich, go swim in the lake, play some more music all night. Like that's all we kind of wanted to do. And that's all there was to do. And that's why we became good, I think. It's just a matter of how you spent on it, or at least for us.
Well, that first album, you know, it's got a very sort of punk sheen to it, more so than anything else. What got you in more of a garage rock direction?
Well, you can hear the seeds of it on that album, but most of it's really fast. I think because we were just really interested in being we were only interested in energy, really. I guess it was kind of like we were more influenced by the Dead Kennedys and stuff, and the garage rock aspect kind of came from. There's a song called "Here We Go Again" on it that's kind of like a Kinks riff, and I think that's when we realized that we like this. And then on like the second album, I mean, the sound is very garagey, but more so like the songs, I guess, are more in that, you know, on the second album, then it more in that kind of 60s vein.
Well, I was wondering
more mid-tempo songs on that one, less fast ones. So, and I think that's what's kind of when we cemented what would then kind of be our style. What we were going to do with Hives.
Well, were you familiar with any? I mean, how familiar with you were you at the time with like Swedish garage rock bands?
The funny thing is, like, our mom, my Niklas' mom's cousin was in this band called the Wild Mammoths, who were on Crypt Records, and that was a really big deal to us. Like, we liked everything on, we bought all our records from Crypt Records for a while. And then we found out that he'd been a band on Crypt Record. Like, I think that was their earliest signing.
Yeah.
And so that was really cool. And I mean, and we liked the Creeps. We got their first album, but that's all we kind of knew about it.
Enjoy like, the
we
Creeps.
Exactly. It's a great record, but we didn't know about like the Nomads, or we didn't know about and any of that guard of garage rock at the time. And like the Helicopters kind of formed at the same time, and that was like a different style, but we felt like they're at least a band from Sweden that kind of, you know, it's at least in the same world where we want to be. Like they're more hard rock, or like Kiss influence and stuff, and have guitar solos and stuff, which we kind of don't, but at least it felt like we felt a kinship. Like, here's a band that likes New Bomb Turks or whatever.
Yeah.
So that felt cool. But no, we weren't aware that there were really other bands doing what we were doing. And we weren't aware of a lot of things. Like, the only reason we started listening to the Stooges is because people said we sounded like them. So it was completely reverse. And then like, oh, this is great. Like, yeah, it kind of does sound like us. So we didn't know about a lot of music. I mean, it was the days of like, you had to save up your allowance. We were still in school, save up your allowance, and you could afford like one record a month, and you'd buy one with a cool cover, and then sometimes it would be bad, but that was what you listened to for that month anyway. So it was a slow research process into garage rock.
Well, I'm really happy that you enjoy that, enjoy the Creeps. That's a favorite album of mine from that.
Yeah,
from
I think that's in that style. Like, that's one of my favorite albums in that kind of orthodox 60s garage style. So they got more funky later, but that record is really great.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I play in I have a band called The Woggles, and we cover Hi, Pretty Girl.
Oh, you're in The Woggles. I know about you guys.
Oh, okay.
That's cool.
Well, there you go.
I didn't know. Yeah, I like your band.
Well, thanks. Well, so continuing on here. That's so cool. I was wondering, how much were you guys touring in those early days before Veni, Vidi, Vicious, you know, kind of blew up? Were you touring a lot, or was it like just doing stuff on the weekends?
We did our first like European tour as the first band out of four, and it was a real diverse bunch because our record company had a lot of different styles. Like, there was us, and there was like a ska band and like a heavy hardcore band and mm-hmm. a like melodic punk band, and we toured Europe together, all of us in like one bus, and it was like the best time. It was so fun. We were first out of four. Sometimes we'd play like before Doors. But we did that European tour, which was like a month of European touring. And then we did like, I guess, weekend shows and stuff. So no real extensive touring. I don't think there was like the demand for it. Like, we were not, like I said, we were wildly unpopular at the time.
Well, there are 500 people that cared a whole lot right off the bat.
I'm not sure they cared, but they bought the record.
Well, maybe.
I think our record company was really popular for other styles of music. So I think that record company had a following more for like a melodic punk kind of thing. And there was probably a following that of at least 500 people who would buy everything that record company put out. So they kind of put it out on like a side label to minimize damage to the main label. So yeah, I think the guys that had the label were like from our hometown, and they were, you know, older, and they were intrigued by what we were doing, and they thought mm-hmm. it was like charming and stuff, but I don't think they thought it could be popular at all.
Well, Veni, Vidi, Vicious comes out, and it's been out, God, like for something like about 23 years ago, 22, 23 years ago.
Yeah, something like that.
Pretty big album, you know, got you certainly noticed worldwide and here in the U.S. Are you still happy?
Yeah, massive, sold millions of records.
Well, are you still happy with how it turned out? I mean, if you play it, do you cringe at any particular song, or do you go, nah, it's as great today as it was the moment that it came out originally?
Well, I usually I don't like records right when we finish them, because you know, you're too close to it and you only hear the faults. But yeah, I think it's like a classic. I think it's really good. And it also means a lot to me because it's like, it's why I can make a living and play every night, and people go nuts for them. And so, yeah, I mean, I owe a lot to that album, and I think it still sounds cool. It sounds crazy. It's got but that's I like that about it too.
Well, since then, you've had like three more studio albums. There's 2004's Tyrannosaurus Hives, 2007's The Black and White Album, 2012's Lex Hives, and now you revealed the death of Randy Fitzsimmons. You know, alas, poor Randy, I knew him not. Perhaps I had an inkling of him all along. Shall we bury Randy Pelle, or should we resurrect him?
Well, that's kind of not up to me. I just know he's missing from my life. I'd like to get him back if he's still around, but, you know, it's hard to, we haven't seen a body, so it's hard to know what actually happened.
So there, he continues to be a presence, though he physically is not here. There is a presence that emanates.
Yeah, and I mean, he's like, in a way that he was like, for the creative bits of it, he was kind of the leader of the band. I mean, he would always have like, you know, one of these people that always has a firm opinion on everything, whether he's right or wrong. And you can kind of miss that. It gets more confusing without that, but. Yeah, I really miss. I mean, I miss him as a person too. But well, I hope if he exists, I'll put out an APB.
Well, you know, you mentioned him having an opinion about everything. I would imagine that he was in.
You got one of them in your
with
band
with yourself and your brother, right? You guys certainly have got opinions about things.
I mean, everybody in this band has opinions about everything. That's why it takes us such a long time to make a record.
Well, that's of course the next question. Why did it take 11 years to release a new album?
Well, since Randy was missing, it's such a long story, but like we toured Lex Hive for like 2 years. Mm-hmm. And then we assumed that Randy would kind of show up again with a grin and some new songs, which he usually would do. Like, we usually didn't have much contact with him when we were touring, because it's kind of intense making a record. And it was nice to just like get some distance. And he would, while we were on tour, which was also, that never happened. So we were kind of without songs. We had two songs. And we waited, and we played shows, and we waited and played shows, and we kind of argued about stuff, like, what's it going to be? Like, what are we doing? And then finally we decided to record the last, like, kind of scraps that we had, which were, like, in 2019, we released 3 songs.
Yeah.
And then there was a pandemic, and then we didn't do anything. And then finally, like, we got the songs, but we didn't get Randy back. So now that we have the songs, it took us, like, a year from grain to loaf, so to speak, to make it, which was like a lot of like what we do to make our rock and roll exciting. Like, our theory for that is to kind of imitate what a debut album is. It's basically you having a lot of time to rehearse the songs, a lot of time to write songs, but very little studio time. Yeah. And I think that works really well for our style of rock and roll. Like, you rehearse till you can play everything backwards and forwards. And then you just kind of stand there and do that. And then 80% of it's done. I feel like that's always been when we've felt like our recordings have been most successful, is when we've done that. Like, we did an attempt at Vicious like 6 months before we actually recorded it, when all the songs were not finished. And that was horrible. Like, trying to like piece together something that sounds like, yeah, I don't know. It's way better this way, we think. I'm off topic now, but there we go.
They're good. So, where did you record the album? Did you use the same studios as you've used before, or someplace different?
Yeah, we used 2 studios we've used before. They're kind of like the nicest studios that we know around Stockholm. It's Benny Andersson from Ebba Studio, which is great, obviously, because he's rich, so he can afford a nice studio. He's also a really cool guy. He used to play in a garage band called Hep Stars in the 60s. Did you know about that?
No, I did not.
They had a big hit with the Cadillac in Sweden. Like, you should check out some YouTube clips. It's pretty cool. So he plays organ, and he even played organ with us on TV when we performed Blood Red Moon on like a talk show. And we got him, because we recorded in the studio, like, hey, we need an organ player for this, for the TV show. We asked Benny.
So the new album.
Then we got like a Farfisa, and all he could play was like garage rock licks.
Good.
And the other studio we recorded, it's called Atlantis, and it's like the grand old dames of Swedish recording studios, where all the like classic 50s jazz and everything was recorded. It's really great, like big nice room and stuff.
Wow! Right. So when you're walking in there, you can feel the history of the room all around you.
Yeah, pretty much. Yeah, you know that like. People have done good work here, so why shouldn't we? So it feels it feels real and serious.
Well, so every child is unique and special, and you know, you as an artist, I think every album must be, right? What was the death of Randy Fitzsimmons a problem child or a golden boy? Like, you guys were well rehearsed, so things must have gone pretty smoothly, or how did they go?
Yeah, once we have the songs and we decided what songs go on there and we rehearsed a lot, then it's smooth. But like, I feel it feels weird saying that it was a smooth process if it took 11 years. Like, it was a very long, unsmooth process to get to the point where it finally was just like kind of just poured out of us. But yeah, a very long lead up to that, which I then, you know, maybe that counts as part of the process. And then it was not easy if we count that.
Well, our coolest song in the world this week is Smoke and Mirrors. And now the liner notes I was given says that there was a whole bunch of Fitzsimmons that contributed to writing it, including Randy, Wilbur, Chip, and Montgomery.
Yeah, we're not absolutely sure who these people are. I mean, it's since we didn't write the songs before, it was all credited to Randy. But I don't know if this is some kind of, because he's dead now, is that like the estate or their brothers? I have never met any of these people, but I know the publishing doesn't belong to us. So like, what can I do?
So I was going to ask, is having so many songwriters contributing to a tune normal for the Hives? And what you're telling me is that normally it was just Randy and these other people, you have no idea who they are?
Yeah, I mean, we got the songs without really talking to Randy about it, obviously. So like, we only have the songs and they were registered already, but we got the songs and we learned them and we arranged them as we saw fit. And then, so it's really weird. Like, no, we don't really know who these people are. We're not, I'll get back to you when I find out.
That sounds good. Well, do you have any idea when the original idea for Smoke and Mirrors came together?
Yeah, it's a bit back. It's one of these songs that's like a Hive song that's usually like we like more when we play stuff that's not so traditional. It's got, you know, it's got very like verse, pre-chorus, chorus kind of pop structure. It was basically us trying to, you know, it's very influenced by kind of late period Ramones, which we feel is like a very underrated period of the Ramones. Like, yeah. I feel like they were good all along, but people keep nagging about the first four records or whatever. Like, I feel like my favorite Ramones is like the late 80s Ramones. So anyway, it was kind of influenced by that. And I guess it was like, usually we're, you know, when we make songs like that, we kind of don't end up using them because it feels like it's very Swedish to write melodies, you know, melodic songs. But this one just felt too good to not put on the record. It's also good for the diversity of the record. But
yeah
it's a really cool song. I really like it.
We got a lyric in there that talks about the crowded cranium. And through all your songs, I think consistent through your records and stuff, is your English wordplay. Your sense of humor with English and overall the albums is great. So your English, is that a product of just your Swedish school education?
Well, Sweden has kind of the big difference is that in Sweden, there were no dubbing, whereas most other countries in Europe, you see an Arnold Schwarzenegger movie and it was somebody else just being Arnold Schwarzenegger. And that would be the same guy in all Arnold Schwarzenegger movies. But in Sweden, it would be Arnold Schwarzenegger talking, but it would be subtitled. So you'd hear someone say something in English and you could read it at the same time. So that's how we learned English, basically. Plus, our mom was an English teacher.
Yeah, there you go.
It's that, though. Everyone in Sweden is this good at English, I think.
Well, that's excellent. That'll make my travels to Sweden that much easier, won't it?
It will, yeah.
Yeah.
And they'll be so excited to talk to you, too. They love Americans in Sweden.
Well, I'll tell you what. We did played in Sweden a couple of times. One time was only time we played in Stockholm was on a boat that was listing a little to the left. So, you know, if jumping up and down on the stage, you know, you have a tendency to almost fall over. But
I know that place. I've been to many shows there.
Right. I had the great misfortune to play. It was like 50 meters from a free helicopter show. So this was like,
oh, no, that's a bummer.
Yeah, it was like 20 people or something like that. But they had the time of their lives and we didn't.
Yeah, of course they didn't.
Hey, another favorite cut of mine off the album is Rigor Mortis Radio. I love the drum part, you know, the intro. Rigor Mortis Radio, is that a critique on commercial radio?
Not really. It's kind of one of these, our version of like one of these 50s insults, make like a tree and leave or whatever. plus, it just sounds cool to say, I think.
Yeah, it is cool.
It features a lot of those like kind of, you know, kind of cool but also kind of lame insults. It's basically one of these, like, sometimes we make lyrics that are kind of like battle raps, or like, I guess in the garage rock context, more like Bo Diddley, you know.
Yeah,
it's basically just bragging about I'm good and you're bad, you know. It's pretty basic stuff, but we always love those songs.
Well, they're a lot of fun. And you mentioned Bo Diddley there, and what's the song, Crash Into the Weekend? Doesn't have a Bo Diddley drum beat, but it does have a beat that's similar to this Bunker Hill song called Hide and Seek. Are you familiar with him at all? Bunker Hill's an R&B guy, played with Lincoln.
Yeah, I love Bunker Hill. Yeah. I love Bunker Hill. I love that. I used to play in a 50s R&B cover band, like with horns and all kinds of stuff. And it was mostly Little Richard stuff. But we did that. Is it Girl Can Help It?
Oh, yeah. She Was Born to Please. Yeah.
Yeah. No, not that one. It's not the Little Richard song. He's got a song that's called something similar.
Oh, you mean Bunker Hill?
Yeah.
Everybody Bunker talk Hill. About the girl can't dance. She's mine.
Yeah, she's mine. Yeah, that's the one I'm talking about.
And it's very, very Little Richard-esque. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Right on. Yeah. Like Little Richard, but with like extra distortion, basically.
What was this?
No, he's Bunker Hill is amazing. I love that too.
Well, what was the name of this Little Richard styled R&B thing you were doing?
Howlin' Pelon is Loyal Royals.
Loyal Royals. That's very cool.
Yeah, it was pretty good.
So,
had suits and the whole shebang. We play like these like kind of 50s rockabilly things mainly, which is kind of a big scene in Europe. Go to Spain and play like festivals and stuff. So it was pretty fun.
And so that's not ongoing, or is it? Or is it?
We haven't done it in a few years. Like, we still might, but, you know, it's a lot of people to drag around.
Hey, on, see, what's another track here? Two Kinds of Trouble, you point out, or all sorts of troublesome twosomes, including Norwegians and Danes. So what kind of trouble are your fellow Scandinavians up to?
Well, it's an AL rivalry as old as time itself. Like, the Danes are happier than Swedes, but they're also kind of dumb. Norwegians are rich because they have oil. They're also kind of dumb. Swedes are depressed but smart.
Well, wait a minute. What about the Finns? How come, you know, what about...
Yeah, I mean, the Finns, they're over there. It's like basically Russia.
So they...
No, the Finns are just quiet all the time, so you don't have to argue with them. I think that might be because they have such a complicated language that it's just easier to not talk.
Well, what's funny is we played once in Copenhagen. I can't think of the name of the place, but we played with the Maggots. And,
oh, cool. I like that band. Great,
right?
Band.
And so we got in there and everybody was speaking English, and which was, you know, very nice for us. And I can't remember, somewhere in the course of the evening, I was like, wow, this is cool. You guys are all speaking English. Makes it easy for us. And I can't remember who this was, whether it was a Dane or a Swede, but the remark was, of course we speak English. Their language is too fucking difficult to understand.
Yeah, it's true. I mean, they sometimes take offense, but I always have to do interviews in English because Danish is really hard to follow. Yeah. Danish is also like apparently the language that children learn last on Earth. Like, you know, like other countries, people learn at like 1 year old, but since it's so hard to understand where words begin and end because they slur everything, I think Danish children learn at like 2. So obviously, it's not as good a language. It doesn't work for communicating. I'm going to get a lot of shit for this, but I'm looking forward to it.
I know, that's right. I was setting you up for that. And you just dove right in. I thought, good man. Keep swimming in the deep water there, brother. You'll make it to shore eventually. Do you have a favorite song on the album, on The Death of Randy Fitzsimmons? A personal favorite?
I got two. I'm partial to Countdown to Shutdown and Stick Up myself. Those are my favorites.
And why is that?
Well, Stick Up has like a different feel from other Hive songs, which I like. It's kind of more of a, has a bit of kind of a, like when Dion is depressed kind of vibe, which I really like. Like, you know, like that kind of Born to Cry style or whatever.
And you know, then, is it got horns on it? Or is that a synthesizer?
Yeah, it's got horns on it.
It does have horns
on
it.
No, those are horns, yeah.
Yeah,
and then cool. Countdown to Shutdown is like a blockbuster Hives hit, I think. And I like that. It's really fun to play live, make the crowd jump up and down, which is, you know, fun.
Well, when you're playing live, do you play, everything off the record? Or what are you playing off the record?
We're playing kind of like half of it or something. It's like 6 songs so far, but we're going to learn some more during this tour. We're excited to play Smoke and Mirrors and The Bomb at least, and then maybe Crash Into the Weekend.
Well, you're going to have to play Smoke and Mirrors when you get here stateside. I know that Today's the 29th. You guys are playing in Munich tonight, but you're going to kick off a U.S. tour October the 30th in Brooklyn, New York. Well, when was the last time you played here in the U.S.?
Was it like last? No, this spring. We did like a short tour, like 2 weeks, mostly L.A. and New York. And yeah. Okay, so it's not too long ago.
But the album wasn't out at that time, was it?
No, it wasn't. We have still not done any kind of U.S. tour with the album out.
Right. So, you know, countries have got pluses and minuses to them for a touring band. What are some of the pluses for touring in the U.S.?
I think that everything is like 10% more fun there, like having a sandwich, going to the beach. I think everything is like, and people are always really excited and oh, not always, like some of them are so-so, but always the crowds we meet are always great. I guess the downside is the food will kill you.
Well, you just have to keep moving, you know, that way.
You got to move a lot.
That way the grease doesn't solidify in your veins, you know, in your artery. Yeah.
A lot of moving around. Yeah.
So one thing I just, you know, this isn't really related to the new album or touring, but just while we're talking, back in 2008, you guys issued this Christmas duet with Cyndi Lauper called A Christmas Duel. And I think the song is just brilliant, just really great. Who came up with the tune and how did you get her involved?
The tune is Randy Fitzsimmons.
Yeah.
And we got her involved by, because our ex-manager, Cyndi Villano, was like our former manager and friend, Cyndi Villano, I was drinking with her and I talked about how much I loved Cyndi Lauper. And she's like, oh, I know her manager. And I'm like, ask her if she wants to do a duet with us. And the song didn't exist at the time. And I just thought we should, you know, we got to do this. Because she's got like one of my favorite voices. It's like her and Ronnie Spector, like my favorite female voices. And then the song came kind of after that, and it was right before Christmas, so it kind of felt like too good an opportunity to pass up. And she was actually playing in Stockholm, so we could get her into the studio. It took a lot of coaxing, though, to get her to sing those lyrics. She was really worried about them because they're kind of racy. But her, she had like a backup singer called Lainey with her, who convinced her to.
Oh, that's way cool. That's way cool. Have you kept in contact with her since?
Well, we did play, like, she has a big like Christmas fundraiser thing at Beacon Theater. We played that 1 year, but not like on a weekly basis or anything.
Not weekly, no. Well, we can only play one other tune from the new album right now, and I'd like us to hear the opening track to The Death of Randy Fitzsimmons, the song Bogus Operandi. Do you have any idea how that song came together?
Yeah, it was kind of like we had the riff for a very long time, and it always felt like a cool intro and so forth, but we didn't know that we wanted to start the album with it, and we finalized the intro, and then we realized that the album has to open this way. But it was always like, we always liked that riff and the groove and the hooks in the verse.
Yeah.
But it took a lot of arranging. Like, we must have played that song 50 million ways before landing on that one. So yeah, it took a lot of work, but we made it.
Well, I love
what it is today.
I love how you talk about the intro there, because it's got, you know, the intro's got this sort of grandiose beginning. And I was thinking it makes a good death march for Randy. Yeah. How about that?
Yes.
Yeah.
We even start the shows now with Chopin's Death March, and then into that. It's very doomy. I feel like we're Black Sabbath or something, which is kind of cool.
Well, Pelle, before we spin Bogus Operandi, thanks so much for talking with me today on our Coolest Conversations.
Thank you. And I hope I see the Woggle at some point. Like your band. Like talking to you. Take care.
All right. Well, right now, here are the Hives with the opening track to their latest album, The Death of Randy Fitzsimmons. It's Bogus Operandi in Little Steven's Underground Garage. Off the Hive's latest album, The Death of Randy Fitzsimmons. That was some of the opening track, Bogus Operandi. This is the Mighty Manfred, and thanks again to the band's lead singer and frontman, Pelle Almqvist, for speaking with me today on our Coolest Conversations. Thanks also to Sammy Semenza for producing our podcast. Jeff Palmer is a pal of ours here in the Underground Garage that we know mainly from his band The Connection, but he's currently playing with Kurt Baker in the Kurt Baker Band. Well, they've released a brand new album, Rock and Roll Club, out on Wicked Cool Records. And Jeff will join us next time around to tell us all about the new release. It's Jeff Palmer on your next Coolest Conversations here in Little Steven's Underground Garage.
Buddy, you're a boy. Make a big noise playing in the street. I'm gonna be a big man someday. You got mud on your face, you big disgrace. Kicking your can all over the place.
Some things are better when they rock. The Seminole Hard Rock Hotels and Casinos rock around the clock with nonstop casino action, rooms fit for the king, pools, spas, restaurants, and clubs for every taste and temptation. Seminole Hard Rock Hotel and Casino in Tampa or Hollywood, Florida. We will rock you.